Welcome back. Tonight's sermon is titled, Do You Not Know? Do You Not Hear? Has It Not Been Told You From the Beginning? And it's a quote from Isaiah. That's not the verse we're going to be looking at. But I really enjoyed that, and I thought it kind of fit the theme of this, that people are missing. They're missing the big picture. They're not seeing what's happening before them. They're not hearing what's being told. And I thought, you know, Isaiah's cry here was terribly fitting for it. And tonight we're looking at a specific event from the life of Christ. And it's more on the overt side of that subtle, not subtle scale that we were talking about. And it's found in the Gospel of John, specifically John 9, 1 through 41. And now it's significant that we find this account in the Gospel of John because John is a very special book. John is, obviously, one part of the four Gospels of Jesus. They recount his life and what he did while he was on the earth. And each one of them approaches the story from a specific viewpoint. It isn't as though they all wanted to write the same account. It's not for the exact same stories. Each writer had a purpose. We had Matthew, who did Jesus as the King of Israel, the Son of David. We had Mark, who's focused more on Jesus' servanthood, his ability to do. You'll notice that Mark has no backstory. We don't know where Jesus come from. He just immediately shows up and he starts working. We have Luke, more of a full history of Jesus. It's kind of his picture as the perfect man. And now these first three are grouped together. I pushed the wrong button. And they're called the Synoptic Gospels. But that being said, why do they get lumped together and poor John here is left out in the cold? Well, it has to do with his point of view. The first three, they all deal with different aspects of Jesus, obviously, but they all revolve around one central theme, Jesus' humanity. But that isn't the whole story of Jesus. We must remember that Jesus was also 100% God. John's gospel differs markedly from the others in this respect. It's focused on Jesus as divine. And another critically important aspect, and this will all come together in a second, of John's gospel, is that in the gospel itself is the reason he wanted to make this account, the reason it was written down. Here, John 20, 30, 31, his purpose statement. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. That's where our journey starts this evening. Everything John wrote in his gospel was to further the case, the proof that Jesus was the Christ, and that if he was the Christ, we could have life by believing in his name. And so when we read something from John, we should be careful to remember that everything being written is to further the goal of showing that Jesus is the Christ. Our text tonight is the account of the man who, being born blind, was healed by Jesus. Now, there are four parties involved in this account. There is the man born blind. There were the crowds. There were the blind man's parents. And there were the Pharisees. And there are just a ton of things we could go over about this whole incident. It's hard to narrow it down. But I kind of want to stay in line with the fact that we find this account in the Gospel of John. That this was written down by John because it served as a proof that Jesus was the Messiah. That's why John wrote the book. So if this story was important enough to include, then John must have thought that it was a very telling miracle. It was a telling in who Jesus was, that Jesus was the Messiah. In fact, didn't Jesus himself make reference to acts like these to allay the concerns of John the Baptist? If you remember, John's in prison, and Jesus isn't quite ascending to the throne the way he thought he would. Things aren't turning out the way he'd hoped, and he begins to wonder. And he sends his disciples to find out from Jesus, are you the Messiah? Are you the one we're looking for? So the disciples come up to Jesus on behalf of John, and they ask him if Jesus was the one they were looking for. Or should we be looking for another? Did I make a mistake? Are we looking for another person to come that's that final Messiah? And Jesus responds in a certain way. He tells them that to go back and to tell John something specific. The blind receive their sight. And the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. These were the signs that testified to Jesus being the Messiah. So when Jesus opened the eyes of the man born blind, the people should have recognized the significance. So we'll just see how they do. If you want to turn to John 9, 1 through 41, we'll just read the account. Bear with me, there's a somewhat of a long section. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. And as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." And having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. He then anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. And so he went and he washed and he came back seeing. And the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" And some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." And he kept saying, "No, I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" And he answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes. And he said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and I washed and I received my sight." And they said to him, "Well, where is he?" He said, "Well, I do not know." So they brought the man to the Pharisees. And it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and it opened his eyes. And so the Pharisees again asked him how he'd received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes, I washed, and I see." And some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "Well, how can a man who is such a sinner do such signs?" And there was a great division among them. And so they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him, since he had opened your eyes?" And the man said, "He's a prophet." The Jews did not believe that he'd been born blind and had received his sight, until they called the parents of the man. And they asked him, "Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" And his parents answered, "We know this is our son, and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He's of age. He'll speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be immediately put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He's of age. Ask him." And so for the second time, they called the man who had been blind. And they said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." And he answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, though, I was blind, and now I see." And they said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" And he answered them, "I've told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we don't even know where he comes from." And the man answered, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." And they answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and you dare to teach us?" And they cast him out. Now Jesus heard that they'd cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Now some of the Pharisees near him heard these things, and they said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you'd have no sin. But now that you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." So out of these four parties who were witness to this miraculous healing, We'd ask ourselves the question, how'd they fare? Did they get it? Did they understand it? Did they react properly? The first group to look at is the crowd. These were the people who knew the blind man. They saw him sitting outside. They saw him begging for however many years he's been out of his parents' house. They knew that his condition was one such that he would never be able to work. He'd never be able to provide for himself. And he'd undoubtedly never have a family. A truly tragic existence. I mean, forget first-class living. Forget champagne and caviar dreams. This man was having less than even a coach class existence. Less than a peanuts and diet right existence. A second or even third-class citizen cursed by God. That's what these people thought they knew about him. So the crowds are witness to his miraculous healing, and what are their thoughts? What response do they have to this miracle? First of all, they doubt. They say, well, surely this can't be the man. The man we know is blind. This just looks like him. But through insistence, the man says, no, I am that man. Other people saying, well, he does look a lot like him. This is sure, I'm having a hard time debating that. So the next thought is, well, this is a great piece of gossip. You know, this is something to do on a Saturday night. I want to go see this Jesus character do some more acts. This is kind of cool. So they say, where is he? You know, what did he do to you? Let's go find him. The man says, well, I don't know where he's at. I mean, I was blind when he healed me. He sent me away. I went and washed. I came back. I don't know what he looks like. So not having any fun there, what do? They run off and they tattle. They go off to the Pharisees and they bring this man up to him and tell him, ooh, look what the Jesus guy's been doing. And they hand him off. Where's the awe? Where's the recognition of God's work? Nobody stops to praise God. Here, one of their own kinsmen has been healed of a terrible affliction that has caused him untold pain and suffering, has left him a life of begging and being at the mercies of others' charity, and now that that's been cured, not a peep. You know, some people once asked Jesus what the greatest commandment was. You know, they were very concerned about getting an orderly list together and making sure they paid close attention to the edicts that really mattered. You know, apparently all 613 precepts, a little onerous. You know, maybe God grades on a curve. We'll hit the ones that are big and important. So they want this little list. They ask Jesus, which commands are the most important? Which one is the top dog? And do we remember what Jesus said? You shall love your Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. But there is a second like it, no less great. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all that the law and the prophets have said. The two commandments, which summed up the whole law, love God, love your neighbor. And here their neighbor, their brother, a fellow Jew, was miraculously healed of a tragic and incurable condition. And there's no praise. There's no slaps on the back, no joy. Where is the love? Where is the fulfillment of this second commandment? Where is the concern for their neighbor, their brother? Not only have they missed the big picture, missed what really matters, that this proves that Jesus is the promised Messiah, the Christ, but they aren't even concerned with this man's well-being. Well, what about the man's parents? The crowds failed. What about these people? Did they get it? Did they understand what had truly happened? I mean, if there were ever anyone who should have been close to this miracle, it should be these folks, right? I mean, this is their son. He is their child. And he's been suffering as a blind man since his birth. These people were as close to this situation as you could get. Certainly, we would expect them to, at the very least, praise God for the mercy given their son, and hopefully understand the significance of what this miracle means. They're called before the council to testify to the identity of the man and to validate his claim to have been blind. But their response is fairly tepid. It doesn't exactly fill one with the warm and fuzzies. You look at their response, if you read your text, and their thoughts are not on what had happened. They're not jumping around excitedly because their son can now see, that he now has a chance at a normal life, to participate in that which we take for granted. Instead, they're scared. They're in fear about what this action will do to them. Yeah, I can almost hear their thoughts. You know, why did this have to happen to us? I mean, isn't it bad enough that our son was born blind? And now he's gone and wrapped himself up with this Jesus character, and once again, we're having to stand around and answer for it. They fear the reprisals from the religious leaders. They knew the standing orders of the day. If you confess Jesus, then you're excommunicated from the synagogue. You're out, which means you do not pass go, you do not collect $200, you go straight to being persona non grata, unwelcomed person. And it isn't something that these two people are willing to endure. You just look carefully at their section of the text once more. They do testify to the man's identity. They are willing to do that. This is our son, and he was born blind. But they refuse to comment on the question of how now does he see? In case we're so inclined to make excuses for these people. You know, well, they weren't there, so how could they say who or how he was healed? John adds some text to help out in case that is your mindset. He tells us that these people knew that to confess Jesus as the Christ was to face a public ban. They were well aware of this. And this tells us, I think, that these people knew who healed their son. It would also possibly indicate that they actually understood the significance of the miracle, because it would seem to suggest that saying Jesus cured the blind man is equal to calling Jesus the Messiah. So they saw exactly what John wants us to see in this account, that Jesus' work is proof that he is the Messiah. But the response to the miracle, their response to seeing that the works Jesus performed testify that he was the Messiah, evasion and fear. They even throw their own son under the bus to avoid facing the truth. They deny what they know, and they tell the council to ask their son. Let him speak for himself. Don't wrap us up in what's going on here. We don't want any part of it. Do you know what the problem with fence sitting is? The fence never wins, ever. These people see the truth, and they recognize the cost of admitting the truth, and so they simply play neutral. They sit this one out. Well, one side's going to win, and one side's going to lose. But that fence, that's a guaranteed losing position, and it's sad that that's the position they choose. Well, we've covered half the parties involved so far, and we're batting zero. Not very encouraging. What about our final two? Pharisees. Now, here's a pretty depressing group of people. The Pharisees were aware of what Jesus was doing, the miracles he was performing, not just this one, but all of them. They knew what he was claiming to be, but they absolutely could not accept it. The evidence was irrelevant. They had already made up their mind as to what their Messiah, was going to be like, and that was going to be that. No one else is going to do. God sent you? So what? Go back and tell him to send us someone better. Tell him to send us someone that we're looking for. And in this particular instance, the Pharisees, they have an issue. And it's an issue they'd come across repeatedly. And they couldn't reconcile how Jesus could do the things he was doing and yet act and teach the way he did. Here in particular, we're told by John that they disputed the day the work happened. For you see, the Pharisees could be accurately described as Sabbath worshipers, acting as though man was made for the Sabbath, even forbidding doing good for your fellow man if it meant breaking the meticulous rules, the regulations they created for what you could and you couldn't do on a Sabbath. And with Jesus healing a man, a work in their eyes, on a Sabbath, clearly he's not following the will of God. But still, he's doing miraculous deeds. As Pastor Paul has said, a miracle, you know, happens when no one can deny it. Same here. These people, they despise Jesus, but they can't deny that a miracle is happening. But yet, how can he be doing it? He's not following God's rules, at least not from their perspective. And so they've tried about everything at some point to get around this dilemma, that how Jesus could be doing miracles, yet be violating the law from their perspective. Going so far as once to say that Jesus worked his miracles through the power of the devil. But here in our story, they try no less hard to find a workaround for this seeming paradox. How could Jesus work on a Sabbath and yet do miracles? How can he do these two things? Well, their first attempt is just to deny the miracle. They try to cast doubt on the story. refusing to believe that the man whom Jesus healed was ever actually blind. It's a con. It's a trick. That's what it is. You guys just fell for it. This is a pretty shallow argument, though. I mean, everyone knows this man was blind. The crowds aren't entirely brain dead. They might be blind as bats, but they know at least this much. The man was blind. But the Pharisees make a big show of the deal anyway. They say, well, we're not going to believe it. We're going to demand proof. Call that man's parents in here. We want testimony that this man was blind. Otherwise, nah, this didn't actually happen. And the text doesn't explicitly say this, but it's kind of my hunch that they'd probably hoped to strong-arm the parents into calling their son a liar. You know, kind of twist their arm a little bit, see if they couldn't just cut the story off at the knees. That way they could write the whole thing off as a fraud. Unfortunately for them, even as self-serving and as fearful as those parents were, they would not deny that this man was their son, that he was born blind. So it's back to the drawing board. If they couldn't just declare the tale a hoax, well, then maybe they could trip up the witness. They ask him to keep telling the story over and over again. And I don't think this was because it was such an unbelievable tale. I think they were hoping that the man would change his story somewhat. You know, if you can get someone talking long enough, then they're bound to trip up somewhere. Maybe I should wrap this up pretty soon. They're looking for a gotcha moment with this blind man. You know, just keep telling us your story. Just keep repeating it. Eventually, we'll find something we can use to discredit it. Some fact will get changed. You know, we'll make you out as a liar, or perhaps we'll find some dirt we can throw on Jesus. Maybe something that'll stick and ruin his popularity, ruin his image. But as we'll see in a minute, that backfires as well. The man doesn't give them what they want, and they run out of options. They're going to have to fall back on that age-old parental adage, because I said so. They're going to throw this man out of the synagogue, and they'll try to discredit him in any way possible so that his testimony won't mean anything to anyone. In short, their mindset is, I said that Jesus is not the Messiah. I've made that determination, and that's just the way it's going to be, and the ends will justify the means, whatever these means happen to be. Now, these men were supposed to be shepherds of Israel, tending to the flock's needs and leading them to spiritual nourishment, making them ready for the coming of Messiah. And what do we see? They refuse the Messiah. And not only do they not celebrate the healing of one of their own, but they willfully offer him up as a sacrifice to further their objectives. They care nothing for the sheep. Is it any wonder that Christ had to give a lecture on what a true shepherd looked like? These men were about as far from servant leaders as you could possibly get. And theirs is perhaps the saddest tale of all, because they didn't really miss the significance to the miracle. They didn't miss what it meant. They just simply flat out rejected it. It was nothing they wanted a part of. In fact, it is a chilling end to this story when one of the Pharisees condescendingly asked Jesus, "Are we also blind? Are you saying that we don't see the truth? Who do you think you're speaking to?" To which Jesus answers, "If you were blind, you'd have no sin." There'd be some kind of hope there, I would say. But since you say, we see, your sin remains. You know, Jesus said it was not the well that needed a doctor, but the sick. The sad thing becomes when one is so blind that they don't even recognize that they're sick. They're living their lives in darkness as to their true condition, and they don't seek healing. They don't think they need it. But one day, there will be reckoning, and the truth is going to be evident. But at that point, they'll be beyond help. All because they refuse to see the truth. Well, that is three groups down, and not a single one gets it. No one sees. No one is understood. Now, these have been exceptionally bad ways to respond to a miracle, to a testimony from God. But I like to go out on a positive note. There is one bright light in this story. One that is weaved throughout the narrative as a beacon to the truth, the man born blind. No one is more acutely aware of what it means to be born blind than this man. We can all guess, surmise, but he's lived through it. He knows what it means to be in this culture, this day, and to be born blind. He's had to live it every day of his life up to this day. And I want to point something out because I think it's interesting. This man has had to live life on the raggedy edge for probably a long time. He then receives the ability to see. Now think about that. He didn't receive something supernatural. He was only brought to what you and I consider normal. He's only given that which you and I take for granted, sight. Now, unlike Job, and this might be adding too much into it, I don't know, we're not told of a blessing of material wealth that came after his ordeal. He isn't made whole, as our insurance, our court systems would say today. He's just given sight, and now it's up to him to start doing something with it. Now, if anyone in the world's eyes would have a legitimate claim to begrudge God, I think it would be this man. And yet his response is proper. It denotes someone who gets it. He isn't owed anything, and neither are we, by the way. And when God steps into his life and gives him his sight, there isn't any sense of expectation, as if this was the least that God could do for him. The man rejoices at his newfound fortunes, and he eagerly tells anyone who asks exactly what happened. And his testimony never changes. It never wavers. It always contains the important details, the whos and the whats. And when they ask him what he thinks about Jesus' work, there isn't a second's hesitation. Jesus is a prophet. He's sent by God. He's a righteous man. How could he not be? How could he not be a righteous man? If he wasn't, he wouldn't be able to do these works. And when he finally meets Jesus, he readily worships him, which is something you only do to God. He understood this miracle. He understood that it proved that Jesus was the Messiah, just as John wants us to see it from this account. I also want to applaud this character for one more attribute that I think each and every one of us should hold in our hearts: courage. We're never told that this man was overshadowed by the Holy Spirit when he was taken before the Pharisees. He had no divinity degrees. He did not have a chance to go and learn under Jesus' teachings. He was taken immediately before the religious scholars and the authorities of the day to give an account for what had happened. Now, this would be akin to you or I being taken off the street one day, and within a few minutes finding ourselves thrown before Congress with all the press cameras and the eyes on you, and, you know, the elevated platform with the eyes looking down at you, and being asked to answer questions. I mean, you want to talk about a stressful situation. That's about as stressful as it can get. And yet this man triumphs. Not because he's a great and eloquent speaker, but because he simply tells the truth. He tells what God has done for him. And that's what we're called to do. You know, I don't think we shouldn't learn as much as we can. And picking up hints on how to be a persuasive speaker, that's not a bad skill to have. But ultimately, we need to be willing and able to say what God has done for us. This man stood before the elites, and he answered to what he knew. He didn't know all the details. He didn't know the entire history of Jesus' life. But he knew one thing. He was blind, and now he could see. And if Jesus could do a great work like that, that said something. It said that God was with him. It also said something about who Jesus was. And there wasn't one thing those men, those well-educated leaders of, you know, their communities, there's not one thing they could do to answer back. Oh, they threw a temper tantrum, all right. They huffed and they puffed, but ultimately there was no response to what he said. How could there be? We saw three very bad ways to respond to a working of God. But here in this last man, we see what our response should be. This is an example of how we should respond to God's workings in our lives. 1 Peter 3:15, I just kind of pulled that one last minute, says, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. That's what we should be like. We should be prepared for this kind of moment. No excuse for timidity. No excuse for not being prepared. No one knows this story better than you. You know why you have hope. You know what great things God has done for you. Just share it. There can be no answers against that. Amen.